Welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. The Republican primary season continues, albeit with fewer candidates as time goes on. Today, we'll talk with Buddy Romer, former governor of Louisiana and a candidate for president. He recently dropped out of the GOP nomination race and is now running for president as a third-party candidate. I'll ask him why. We'll also talk with healthcare advocates Family USA about the other presidential contenders and their positions on the Obama healthcare plan. What would healthcare look like under a President Romney or Santorum? What's the position of medical doctor and libertarian Ron Paul when it comes to national healthcare efforts? And does anybody know exactly where Newt Gingrich stands on this issue? Later on in the program, I'll be talking with Ron Pollock from Families USA. But my first guest today is former Louisiana governor and presidential candidate Buddy Romer. Governor Romer led Louisiana from 1988 to 1992 and served four terms in Congress. He was part of the bevy of Republican candidates seeking that party's presidential nomination, but recently he bailed out of that race and announced he would be mounting an independent effort to capture the highest office in the land. Welcome, Governor.
Thanks. Good to be here, Lynn.
I'm very pleased to have you. So before we get into the independent run, which I think is really, really interesting, why did you decide to run for president in the first place?
I was concerned. I'm 68, so I'm not a baby, and I've looked at America in variety of ways over the last 60 plus years, and I've never seen it more unfocused and divided and not unified in any regard. And the result is that we have lost our manufacturing jobs, and we continue to lose them. And we have lost our focus on our children and grandchildren and get further away from reality. And the thing that brought it home, Lynn, was I begin to chronicle, to monitor the overwhelming power of a few special interests. They fund campaigns. They write the tax law. They keep the budget out of balance with their earmarks. They won't allow meaningful health reform. They oppose fair trade. They don't look at bank reform except how to help the big boys who already own too much. And no matter what issue I looked at, I decided that reform, that cleaning up the money was the first step, and no candidate, Democrat or Republican, were talking about it. So I decided to get in the race and talk about it.
Well, I'm looking at your resume. I mean, you have an MBA from Harvard, from the business school. You've been a businessman. You've been a farmer, a banker, a congressman, a governor. That's a resume that should have a lot of traction. Do you feel like you have been given the opportunity to get your qualifications out there, to get your message out there?
I don't. Now, I'm not a crybaby. I know it's a tough business, and I know there are a lot of people who would like a chance to be president. But just focusing on the facts, I was the only Republican, now the only independent, the only candidate for president who had been elected both congressman and governor. Mm-hmm. I know Ronald Reagan told me one day that I was 36. I was in Congress, and I was in the White House in the Oval Office, and we were talking about the boll weevils. I was a Democrat then and a conservative, and we'd put 43 Democrats together who were willing to support the president when we thought he was right, and I was the leader of that group, and I was there in the White House with the president
afternoon. This was the predecessor of the Blue Dogs.
That's correct.
The boll weevils.
That's correct.
Okay.
A much larger group. Congress then overlapped from left to right.
Right.
Party was not as important as it seems to be now. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we were talking, and the president turned to me, President Reagan did, and says, Congressman, you're going to try to be president someday, aren't you? And it kind of caught me by surprise. And I said, well, gosh, Mr. President, give me some advice. Maybe I will. I said, what should I do? He said two things. He said, you need to be governor of your state. He said, I'm not going to vote for a person for president unless they've been governor first. He said, that's what focused my mind and gave me the ability to do it. And then I said, what's number two, Mr. President? He said, you're in the wrong damn party, buddy. You ought not be a Democrat. You ought to be a Republican. So now, years later, I was a Democrat for 20 years. I've been a Republican for 22 years, and finally I'm an independent.
Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show here on 89.1 WEMU, and I'm talking today with former Louisiana governor and presidential candidate Buddy Romer. So, Governor, we were talking about getting your message out. It seems like there were a number of candidates, and I would particularly focus on you, who got left behind in the Republican race, in the sense that you were not always included in the debates, the comments and the programs that you put forward didn't make it to the press, weren't part of the sort of the newscast. Is that a fair way of assessing how it was for you?
No, it's fair. I was the only candidate not to be invited to a single debate. I was zero for 23. I mean, Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, was invited to two, but I was the only candidate, a congressman or a governor, not invited to a single debate. Never could give me a reason. They always had an excuse. I don't think, and let me say this as an independent, just as an American, I think both parties are joined at the billfold. And I don't think they want to talk about the money they get. They don't want you to know about it. They don't want you to know the price they pay for it. They don't want you to know a full disclosure of who gives the money and why. Let me put it this way. 4 years ago for president, Obama and McCain got more money from Washington, D.C. lobbyists and PACs than they did from 32 states combined. Let me tell you, Washington is bought and sold by the special interests. That doesn't mean they win every fight. They don't care about winning every fight. That doesn't mean that they choose between Democrats and Republicans. They don't care about Democrats and Republicans. They want a tax code that gives them a favor. They want a special earmark in the budget. They want trade initiatives that emphasize free rather than smart. I mean, these are the kinds of things that drive me crazy. Well, and being out of office for the last 16 years, about a year and a half ago, I started looking at the facts, and Lynn, I didn't like what I saw.
Well, leaving office and being an observer gives you an entirely different perspective. I mean, I would absolutely agree. But I don't want to soft pedal the money issue because, frankly, it takes a lot of money to run for president. How are you going to raise your money, or how do you hope you can pay the cost of advertising, getting your message out there, competing in this kind of a environment?
It's hard to do when most of the American population are just couch potatoes.
Right.
They just watch it.
Well, what's your plan?
It's like a carnival.
It is.
It's all these commentators are about who's ahead. It's like a horse race. Rather than picking a CEO or a leader or somebody to lift your children in the future. I mean, we've got this all backwards now in America, and it comes from the money. Those in power like the status quo, Lynn. They've never made so much money. They've never had so much influence. It's when you talk about America being a republic where people are responsible for their leaders, then you see what a disconnect we have. Let me tell you again. There were 1 billion cell phones made in the world last year. None were made in America. I watched the leader, the next president of China, come to Los Angeles 2 weeks ago to cut a ribbon at the port of Los Angeles to celebrate the fact that 80% of our trade with China goes through the port of Los Angeles. And then I read the article. Here's what it showed. $130 billion was imported into America from China. Do you know how much China bought back from us? $12 billion, 130 to 12. I mean, 11 times as much is bought by America than is sold to China, and we do nothing about it. I've been to China 30 times. I've been to every province in China on my own payroll. I've seen children work in the factories 12 hours a day. I've seen millions of prison laborers who have no rights, who are not treated like human beings, and we let those products roll into America while they stop our products from going to China. Well, it's just an example, Lynn, of how the political establishment takes money from GE and Wall Street, and GE and Wall Street close American plants, build them in China, and sell the products back to America.
I think you have a very strong populist message. The question is how does a candidate take that popular outrage, the anger that Americans feel, turn it into a successful campaign, and then ultimately into strong leadership? I mean, I think back to another Southern populist who ran as an independent, and that's H. Ross Perot. He had $68 million of his own that he could drop into that race. I'm pretty sure you don't have $68 million in your back pocket. So what's your plan? How are you going to get in front of the public? How are you going to get this message out? And while you and I will not agree on a number of things because I'm a Democrat, but I agree with the populist message that you have, the idea that we are a popular sovereignty, the people hold the power, the people elect their representatives. How do you get yourself in front of the people and say, look, I'm a good person for you to support?
First, I stand up.
Okay.
I'm standing. I mean, we're having a conversation, and I don't give a damn whether you're a Democrat or not. You're an American, and we share a lot more values than we disagree on.
Correct.
I can guarantee you that.
Yep.
And number two, I'm asking others to join me. I can't do this by myself. I had to take the first step. I stand. In a field where it's been leveled by the big boys, I challenge them. I challenge the political system. How can I win? Challenge them. I need help. I need 1 million people to stand with me. I mean, we've got 314 million Americans in this country. I'm asking 1 million to stand with me.
Let me
answer this now. If 1 million people stand with me, my rules are very clear. I take no PAC money. I took no PAC money as governor or as a candidate for governor. I took no PAC money as a candidate for Congress or being reelected 4 times. I mean, I am free and independent. Free to lead is what we need as a president. And we need a president that stops building his party and starts building his country. And the way to win is real easy. You challenge the American citizens who are getting their jobs stolen from them, whose prospects are less than they used to be, and you say, have you got $50 that you could stand up and contribute to having this message go out? If you like this message, would your family come together and give $25 or $50 or $75? I have 20,000 contributors. That's more than all the other candidates put together. I've gotten money from every state in America. I have raised $500,000. My average gift is $25, and we are just starting. Specifically, I'm going after the Americans Elect ballot. That's on all 50 ballots in the state. I will be different from the Democrats and the Republicans. I won't talk about my party. I'll talk about my country. But I cannot win, Lynn, unless people care enough to get up and say, BuddyRomer.com.
Are you considering any other of the third parties that are out there, the independents, the Independent Party, the Reform Party,
yeah,
or are you really focusing on America Elects?
They've all called and talked to me, and I honor them. They have an issue they think is important, and a lot of what I talk about are in the Independent Party. I know Minnesota's been very interested in the Reform Party. I know Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey been very. They've all called, but I've taken the position that look, I want your help, but Americans Elect will be on all 50 ballots. There'll only be 3 groups on all 50 ballots. Republicans, Democrats, and Americans elect.
Well, let's talk about Americans elect, okay, because they're really they're approaching this in a very modern way. They're internet based. So talk a little bit about who they are and what they're trying to do.
Sure. They are a not-for-profit organization that doesn't give positions. They don't take, they're not looking for someone. They don't have a favorite candidate. They are a unity party. They are for the purpose of this election. If you run for president in that banner, you would pick a vice president who is a member of another party. I would pick a Democrat. Mm-hmm. And you would run to effectuate what you think is needed in America to be strong again. And this is the only reason I run. So I like what they've done in this. They don't give you money.
Mm-hmm.
They don't give you any contributions. They don't give you any positions. They run internet. They have about 600,000 members now, and they're growing about 25,000 a week. Their members come from all forms of American society, Democrats, Republicans. It fits me. My $500,000 that I raised at $25 average gift, about 40% of my contributors are Democrats, about 40% of my contributors are Republicans, and about 20% independents. So this is a natural fit for me.
Mm-hmm.
I like joining forces with a Democrat who makes sense, and many of them do. So it won't be caught up in party labels. It'll be the right kind of thing. It starts in May. You can get on AmericansElect.org, and see how to join. You don't have to give up your party. You can remain a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, but they'll pick their top six.
Right. They're going to do an internet primary.
They'll do an internet thing. It's very interesting. It's very 21st century. What I like about it, it's so different from the kind of garbage that we have now, where parties get together, they write up a set of rules that no one really pays any attention to, and they try to keep this election between two average candidates. Look who they've got this time. It's going to be Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. Give me a break. Is that the best we can do? I mean, Barack Obama talked about change. He's raising $1 billion to get reelected, and the first fundraiser he had was on Wall Street, hosted by Goldman Sachs. I mean, that's BS, and Mitt Romney is the 1%. There is no change in America. It's time. Look, if you care about this country, gang, it's time to try something different. Why don't we try a candidate free to lead? Why don't we try a candidate whose first bill will be House Bill 1, which reforms campaigns? Why don't we try that and see what happens?
Well, let's do this. Break this down. I want to talk just a little more about Americans Elect, because it's a new idea, and then we'll talk about the GOP field, and we'll talk about President Obama. But on Americans Elect, I went to their website a couple of weeks ago. I looked at their advisory board. It's a real mix of Democrats, Republicans, some very high-profile people, some not so high-profile. Now, once they choose their candidate, you say that they have a spot on all 50 states on the ballot.
Right.
Is the expectation that once they've chosen a candidate, they're going to give that candidate some sort of volunteer support or monetary support? Are they going to actually?
I don't take it. Let me be very honest. And it might be an inflexibility that defeats me, but it's an inflexibility that would make me serve. You would be proud to serve with me, Lynn. I'm telling you, we can turn this country around. But I will not take money that's not fully disclosed. I will not take money that comes in increments of more than $100. I have my rules. They're rules of a lifetime that I'm comfortable with, and I will not change them for any party or any group.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that this would be institutional money, but is the thought that the people who are supportive, the people who participate in the primary, will then volunteer
yes,
and grassroots
yes,
give money?
Now. Yes. Oh, definitely. You look, my campaign is an internet campaign now. Mm-hmm. You've already pointed out the weakness of what I do is that I don't have tens and hundreds of millions of dollars from a few rich people or parties or special interests. I'm running a grassroots campaign. I've always done that. I beat an incumbent Democrat for Congress. We have a state in Louisiana with open primaries. They don't care about parties. And so I ran against this incumbent Democrat as a Democrat, and I whipped his ass. I ran the same way for governor against an incumbent Democrat. He'd been elected governor three times. He spent $20 million. I spent $800,000, and I whipped him. And I was free to do tax reform, budget reform, lowered the tax rate. We dropped unemployment in Louisiana from 12.8% to below 6%. It can be done, but you can't be slave to the special interest. You have to be free to serve. So what I like about Americans Elect is that they have the principles of free to serve. You can join with the other party. You don't have to change your party presentation, and you can put your country first. That's what we need this time.
Okay, listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU. We are talking with former Louisiana governor, presidential candidate Buddy Romer. Governor Romer is running as a third-party candidate or as an independent. Now, let me ask you, Governor Romer, about yes. The GOP field. You started out in working with the Republican Party, the Republican primaries, as we talked about a little bit ago.
I was a Republican, right?
Yeah, you got left behind. What do you think? You know, right now we have a neck and neck race. It looks like between Santorum and Romney. Romney, as you say, the 1%. Santorum really resonating to some people on a conservative social agenda, the sort of hot-button issues. What about all of those kinds of issues, gay rights, gay marriage, abortion, contraception? What kind of positions do you take on that, or do you take positions on those sorts of things?
Well, I don't emphasize those things because those things are not why I run for president. I mean, how you lead your life is your business. Well, as long as you don't hurt others. I mean, I'm a traditionalist in terms of marriage, but I've come to the position as I've learned more about what people's needs are and their fears are and their loves are, that a state has a right to make that decision, and I can live with that. I don't think the federal government ought to make it. Rick Santorum seems like a decent guy, but I don't share his stumping the bench or the pulpit about what values Americans ought to have. That's our decision. I think that's the problem with government. It interferes too much in things that it has no business being into them. And so I'm a very much what the job of government is. The job of government is to protect our rights. The job of government is to make sure that this country remains strong. But the biggest enemies of our country come from within, not from without. And let me be very specific. I worry about a country when fewer and fewer people vote. I worry about a country when fewer and fewer people give $10 or $20 or $3 to a presidential candidate. I worry more and more about a country of takers rather than makers. And we've quit making a long time ago. Find something made in America. Call me immediately when you do. This is a country that has its priorities just backward. And sometime, someplace, somewhere, a president's going to be free to lead and change that. And that's what I think this election is about.
Well, let's turn to President Obama. Specifically, where do you differ with him, or what do you think he's done wrong in his first term here?
Well, he's a typical president. I don't think this is a time that needs a typical president.
Well, what would you have done differently?
I'll be very specific. Uh-huh. I mean, China sucks him up and spits him out. He doesn't even get it. You know, I've been to China more times than he has. He ought to come with me sometime and see how it works. His whole health care reform was a disaster. Here's who he had in the room, Lynn. He had lobbyists from the pharmaceutical companies. He had lobbyists from the large hospitals. He had lobbyists from the insurance companies. He had lobbyists from the tort lawyers. You didn't get health care reform. The problem with health care reform is cost and coverage.
He didn't address either of those. What would the
insurance companies ought to compete?
What would the rumor?
They ought to be under the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Okay. But
what
would
Romer compete? You cannot buy health care across the state line.
Right.
So, do you know that?
I understand you can't.
Do you know
insurance.
Why that? They are the largest contributors to congressmen of any industry in America. And here's what they want when you take their PAC check. Oh, man, don't change this McCarran Act. We don't want to have to compete across the state line. We have special needs in our state. BS.
The cost
of health care can be reduced 10 to 15% if insurance companies had to compete.
So,
or if pharmaceutical companies had to compete. Guess who Obama called first on health care reform? The head of the Pharmaceutical Association. He told me directly. He said, I was called five times by the President of the United States and asked not to oppose health care.
And we're talking about Billy Tozen.
And if they agreed to that, they would be protected in the bill. Is that the way you write a health care bill, Lynn?
I'm with you in terms of the influence of special interests. But I'm really interested in knowing what a Romer health care reform plan would look like, how you enlarge the access and the quality of health care.
Lowering the cost. I mean, this is not rocket science. You know, what if a guy said, well, an automobile is $100,000 minimum? And you were a representative of people and say, well, there's so few people that can have automobiles then. What's the first thing you would do? Get a marketplace that lowered the cost of automobiles. Not have a government regulation that everybody has to have an automobile. I work at it completely different. I guess that's what this Harvard degree in economics and this Harvard degree from the business school does. I know how the marketplace works best, and it works best with more competitors and more choices. Here's what I would do. Four things. I would take away the protection of pharmaceutical companies from price discounts and competition from Canada. Number two, I would require insurance companies to compete by putting under the Sherman Antitrust Act. Number three, I would do tort reform that did away with the frivolous lawsuits that are killing American doctors. And number four, I would allow a 25% incentive for every health care provider, if they could document savings over the course of a year, they could keep 25% of the savings that they earned the American citizens. Now you're talking. I would work toward a system where the age in Medicare was slowly raised by 1 month a year for 24 years. I would do the same thing with Social Security. You wouldn't have to raise any taxes or cut any benefits, and you would lower health care costs by 2.25% a year, and it's in balance.
Governor Romer, you are speaking truth to power, as they say, and for folks who like your message, how do they find you? How do they volunteer? How do they give you money?
I'm buddyromer.com, and that Romer is spelled R-O-E-M-E-R. I apologize. It's an Ohio family. My granddaddy came from Zanesville, Ohio, moved to Louisiana when he was a young man, and that's where we've been for the last 100 years. But it's buddyromer.com, and Romer is R-O-E-M-E-R. M-E-R.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thanks, Lynn. You were great.
It's wonderful to have you. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Joining me now is Ron Pollack, the founding executive director of Families USA, a national organization for healthcare consumers. Families USA's mission is to secure high-quality, affordable health coverage and care for everyone in the U.S. He's also a lawyer and a member of the U.S. Supreme Court Bar and has appeared on the PBS NewsHour, The Today Show, Good Morning America, all of the network nightly news programs, and NPR's All Things Considered and Morning Edition. He's often quoted in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the Los Angeles Times. Ron Pollack, nice to have you back.
Delighted to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, the last time we talked, we were just beginning to look at the Affordable Care Act. We've now got a little bit of time with some of the provisions in place. Bring us up to date on the current state of the law.
Well, some of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act are now being implemented. The bulk of them actually get implemented in January of 2014. But for those people who are affected by the items that are already being implemented, this has provided very significant help. I can give you a few examples of that.
Good.
And let's focus on the number of people in Michigan who are being helped by these things. Michigan has 1.7 million people who are on the Medicare program. There are two very significant benefits that are already in effect that people on Medicare are experiencing. First, almost three-quarters of the people in Michigan who are Medicare beneficiaries have taken advantage of a benefit that provides preventive care services for free. No deductibles, no co-payments, things such as mammograms, colonoscopies. And so it's wonderful that the program is becoming more of a health program than simply a sickness program, and people are getting these preventive care services. Then there are a substantial number of Michiganders who are on the Medicare program who have very high prescription drug costs. And they fall into this huge gap in coverage that, you know, as in Washington, we call a donut hole.
Right.
It's really a euphemism, but it's a huge gap in coverage. It's a no-coverage zone for thousands of dollars. And that coverage gap is going to be eliminated ultimately.
By the ACA.
Yes. But right now, as a phase-in to getting it totally eliminated, people are receiving rebate checks to cover half their costs in this coverage gap. And last year, there were 91,000 people in Michigan who received these rebate checks. So that's rather significant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going to the other end of the age spectrum,
right,
for children, the Affordable Care Act right now prohibits an insurance company from denying health care coverage to a child when that child has a pre-existing condition. So if the child has diabetes or asthma, you know, these are common ailments,
mm-hmm,
but they often have been used by insurance companies to deny coverage. Now that no longer can be a basis for denying health coverage. And in Michigan, there are 181,000 children who have such pre-existing condition who now are able to get health care coverage as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Moving a little bit up the age spectrum, there are young adults, people who've just finished college or might be in entry-level jobs or might be looking for jobs and haven't gotten them yet and have difficulty getting insurance. The Affordable Care Act allows those folks to stay on their parents' policy until their 26th birthday. And there are 98,500 Michiganders in that age group who are now getting health care coverage through their parents' policies. So that's very important. So there are a whole bunch of things. We can go on. But there are huge improvements that already exist.
Mm-hmm. This is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU. I am talking with Ron Pollack. He is the founding executive director of Families USA, a national organization for healthcare consumers. Ron, I want to ask you, in the recent negotiations, budgetary negotiations that have been going on in the Hill, there's a suggestion that President Obama may be negotiating away some elements of the bill or of the plan, that he's sort of backtracking. Do you see that to be happening? Do you fear that there's a problem there?
No, I don't see the president doing that. I'm in frequent contact with key folks in the White House and in the Department of Health and Human Services that have responsibility for the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. They're hard at work at trying to get this implemented. I'm not seeing anything in the nature of any meaningful backtracking at all. Quite the contrary. I think the folks who have responsibility for this legislation are working real hard so that the other provisions that go into effect on January 2014, that they'll be fully ready to do so.
Good. Let me ask you about this issue that has come up. It's been everywhere, this issue of contraceptive coverage as part of insurance coverage. This is actually part of the preventive care you were talking about with Medicare. It seems like it has been completely misunderstood. Can you explain how contraceptive coverage got into the bill, why it's there, and how it gets paid for?
You know, what's unusual about this debate is that most employer health plans actually do include preventive care services, with contraception being a part of that. And remember, it's a whole lot less expensive to provide contraceptive coverage than it is to deal with some other alternatives to a potential pregnancy, whether it's actual a birth of a child where the parents were not really prepared to have children. And so this is viewed as a preventive care service. It's a very common service. There are those, I think, who want to make an issue out of. They tend more frequently than not to be men rather than women.
The thing that I have found that I think is a tremendous misunderstanding is people say, I shouldn't have to pay my taxes to have somebody else have sex. This does not require taxpayer dollars to underwrite this, does it?
No, this is really this benefit is really going to be included as private insurance benefits. Remember, one of the things that the Affordable Care Act does is it creates a new marketplace where people can purchase private insurance. And then the question, and by the way, a significant number of people who previously could not afford private insurance are going to get some help with that if they're going to get tax credit subsidies. But it's the purchase of private insurance. And what almost all the analysts will show is that this doesn't add to costs. It reduces costs because it avoids much more expensive costs later on. So this is not going to harm the taxpayer.
Ron, we're in the middle of a presidential election year. President Obama's position on this is very clear because he shepherded the legislation through and has defended it very vigorously. But we have a GOP field that, I think it's fair to say, are not particularly supportive. Can you give us sort of insight into, let's say, the top three, Gingrich, Romney, and Santorum, their point of view here and their history on this issue?
Well, it's really easy to do that, especially with Governor Romney. We actually released an analysis a few weeks ago that, using the colloquial, compared Romneycare with Obamacare. And most people think that the similarities between the two are that they both have and a so-called individual mandate that requires people who can afford coverage to purchase it. Well, yes, indeed, they are similar in that respect. But our analysis shows that on all the key provisions in the Affordable Care Act, what happened in Massachusetts when Governor Romney served as chief executive of the state, that legislation in Massachusetts truly became the model for the Affordable Care Act. In each of the key provisions that we analyzed, and you can get this from our website, www.familiesusa.org, that's familiesusa.org, you get it for free, just pull it off our website, you'll see that they're virtually identical. And helping us with this analysis was a fellow who actually was one of the key developers of both RomneyCare and Obamacare, someone who worked in Massachusetts during the development of the Massachusetts health care plan and played an integral role in its development and passage, and then wound up on Senator Kennedy's staff and helped with the development of the president's proposal. So I would say that, you know, if you look at the history of Governor Romney, he is supportive of the key tenets, not just the individual mandate, but virtually everything that's in the Affordable Care Act. So obviously, when he now talks about repealing that, it's, you know, it's a change of position. And I guess what was good a few years ago from his perspective and that he pushed, he's now criticizing, although it's very interesting. USA Today had a piece this week that showed that when Governor Romney was interviewed just a few years ago, he said that he thought the Massachusetts legislation should be the model.
Yes.
So you've got to take it from there. Now, with respect to the other two key combatants for the Republican nomination, Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich, you know, Newt Gingrich actually supported an individual mandate in the mid-1900s as an mid-1990s.
Right. I was there then, and I remember him doing that.
Yeah, it was an alternative to the proposal by President Clinton. And now, I wouldn't say the same thing about Rick Santorum, but many of the ideas that are contained in the Affordable Care Act were originally Republican ideas. This idea of creating a new marketplace, as the Affordable Care Act does, and arraying a variety of private health plans and providing some support to people through tax credits if they can't afford to pay the premiums, that's a Republican idea. So I think the Republican opposition that has occurred to the Affordable Care Act is more of an element of political positioning rather than ideological consistency.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to The Lynn Rivers Show. Today we are talking with Ron Pollock, the founding executive director of Families USA. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act and the political environment in which it's being debated this year. Ron, I want to turn to the Supreme Court hearing that is coming up. I know that you were the dean of the Antioch Law School. You've argued in front of the Supreme Court even two cases in one day and won both, which is pretty amazing. So with your legal hat on, what do you see happening there?
Well, it's really hazardous to predict this Supreme Court. I you know, I've been to the various arguments that have taken place in the courts of appeals across the country, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Michigan,
right.
The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the 11th Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit. I think by far the stronger argument is about the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. I would say there are two main issues that are going to be debated. One is the constitutionality of this
the individual mandate?
Yeah, I call it the individual responsibility provision, mm-hmm. where if you can afford it, you have to
purchase
the coverage. And if you don't, then you have to pay a tax penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that about one-sixth of America's economy is spent on health care. And to regulate how it gets paid for clearly is part of what was envisioned by the Commerce Clause. And it's very important to remember that if somebody doesn't buy insurance but then needs health care, all the rest of us are going to pay for that person.
Right. You know, one of the things that I've seen is that the Obama administration tried very hard at the beginning to not call it a tax, to call it something else. Wouldn't it have been easier for them to win this debate by calling it a tax? There's absolutely no argument to be made that Congress doesn't have the power to tax.
That's right. Well, you're absolutely right. It kept on calling it a penalty rather than a tax. But, as you know, it's enforced through the IRS, and you pay this penalty as part of your taxes on April 15th. And so, you know the old expression, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. But you're right, it would have been easier had it originally been called a tax, because there is no question that the federal government has the authority under the Constitution to tax people.
Now, let me pose this question to you as a teacher of the law. You played that role. You know, we all learn early on that you have to have certain things in order for a case to move in the federal system. You have to have standing. You have to have a real injury to a real person. You have to have ripeness. Everything that needs to have happened has. Where is the standing here, and where is the ripeness? We're litigating stuff that's going to happen in the future.
Well, that's a very good point. And in fact, the very first this argument is going to last over 3 days.
Right.
And the first issue that the court is going to consider is whether the so-called Anti-Injunction Act applies. And what the Anti-Injunction Act says is that if somebody is charged a tax, they may not challenge it until that tax liability falls due. And so, assuming the court says this truly is a tax, it doesn't fall due till somewhere around April of 2015. And so one of the decisions that the court may make is they may defer on this individual responsibility provision and say it's not ready for litigation. It's really barred by the Anti-Injunction Act, and we will defer it till April of 2015. Now, there's another issue that the court will be considering, and that's the constitutionality of the Medicaid expansion. And that's an extraordinary argument. Nobody expected that issue to come up before the court. In the 47-year history of the Medicaid program, where there's been expansions for children, for pregnant moms, for people with disabilities, and for seniors, there has never been a successful challenge to any of those expansions in any court, let alone the Supreme Court. What's interesting is that the plaintiffs in that case are complaining that there is coercion that's coercing the states to implement this expansion. Now, what makes that so extraordinary is the federal government is picking up 100% of the cost of the expansion from 2014 through 2016, and thereafter, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that this will only add less than 1% of the cost that the states would have borne in the absence of the Affordable Care Act, the provisions related to Medicaid. And if you look at the Affordable Care Act in its entirety, states are going to have a fiscal windfall of about $100 billion through 2019.
Okay.
And so what the states are saying, this is coercing us because we, even though we have a right to drop out of the Medicaid program, we're getting such generous support
Ron,
from...
I have to cut you off because we're running out of time. Ron Pollock, I want to thank you so much for being here with me today.
Happy to be with you.
Wonderful. I also want to thank Buddy Romer for being here as well. Please join me next week for another edition of the Lynn Rivers Show, when we'll talk about the news, politics, history, or a mixture thereof. Radio that makes you think. The Lynn Rivers Show, right here on 89.1 WEMU.